opera or Sondheim, which is a love of mine, on a wide variety of subjects. Francis Davis is the is a contributing editor to the Atlantic magazine, is at work on a book on Coltrane. We had a nice presentation on Coltrane earlier, the day before yesterday. And there is a Francis Davis reader in the works. As I said, his eloquence of his writing was recently pointed out to me, and sort of as jazz critics are sometimes want to do or forced to do, sort of rebut each other. There was quite a debate in the Jazz Times that Francis was a part of, and his rebuttal to some criticism was just calm, eloquent, and reasoned, and I think it ultimately led to the dismissal of the other writer from his job. But I don't think it was Francis's fault. The guy did himself in. In any case, I'm very pleased that he's taken time out of his schedule to come down here and talk to us, Francis Davis. Thank you. Can you have a seat in? Yeah. So I'm going to give it to Brian here.
Okay. I'll be doing it at the end. I'm not responsible for Stanley Crouch getting fired. That's what Sam was talking about. So I don't know if the joke that I was planning on opening with is in good taste any longer. But originally, Stanley and I were going to do this together as Reuben and Clay from American Idol. that's right. But Stanley, who was going to be Reuben, said that he wasn't willing to lose that much weight. Those of you who get the joke, kind of explain it to the others, and we'll use the buddy system here. I got an interesting email the other day, and I know that for years, bad comedians and speakers everywhere would begin by saying, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the studio. So by telling you I got an interesting email, I'm keeping up with that tradition, but just modernizing it a little bit, I guess. The email was from my friend Irene, who's the director of something called the Herb Alpert Foundation out in Santa Monica. And I should explain the Herb Alpert Foundation, since a lot of people might not know about it. Herb Alpert, who made a fortune with his Tijuana Brass, and then another fortune as the A in A&M Records. He gives money away, which sounds like a nice thing to do, but he gives away $250,000 a year, $50,000 each, to individual artists in five different disciplines. And this is really commendable, especially at this time, because as you may know, the National Endowment for the Arts no longer funds individuals, only organizations, in the aftermath of Karen Finley and Robert Mapplethorpe. And you know, whatever this change in policy was intended to accomplish, in terms of jazz, I mean, one thing it's done is just to create more red tape and more levels of bureaucracy that an individual musician has to tear through. It's funny, I mean, in the years I've been listening to jazz, the audience keeps getting smaller and smaller, and the bureaucracy surrounding jazz with all the organizations gets larger and larger. And I think it just means that if you're a musician, like, there are now more asses than ever to kiss if you want to get a gig. You don't just have to buddy up to club owners anymore. Anyway, I served on the music panel for the Alpert Awards earlier this year, which is how I met Irene, who's the director. And she's in New York this week. making the announcements of who got them this year. And this morning she was hosting a breakfast for the new fellows, the new Alpert fellows, and past Alpert fellows, and panelists like me. So she invited me, but I told her I couldn't make it because I was committed to be here. And you know, you shouldn't feel sorry for me for passing up this breakfast, because I didn't really want to go, because for one thing, when you think about it, that free breakfast would have gotten pretty expensive when you figure in the price of a round trip on Amtrak and maybe even a hotel for last night, so I could be there bright and early. But also, I wanted to be here because I feel a kinship with you as a collector myself. So I sent Irene an email declining and explaining why I couldn't be there. And based on what I took away from a conversation I had with Sam months ago, I mistakenly, or maybe not so mistakenly, I'm not sure, I told Irene that this was a convention or a conference of recorded sound collectors. I didn't know there were also record collectors. that this was a conference of recorded sound collectors, which is what I believed until I got an email from Sam yesterday. But anyway, this is what Irene wrote back, if I can find it. She said, "Would you let me know the range of sounds they are interested in?" This is fascinating. I still remember an incident. I still remember an incident from my childhood. My mother came home with a record which we thought would tell the story of a train. And lo and behold, it only had train sounds, and I cried. Even then I was destined to be most beguiled by narrative. Well, you know, me too. I mean, as a writer, narrative is my life. Even in a nonfiction piece, there's a narrative. I mean, you have to figure out what the reader needs to know in order to appreciate this other piece of information that you want to spring on them. And then you have the, you know, God, how do you keep anyone interested at a certain point? So, you know, narrative is my life. So I know what Irene means, but I think I disagree. Those train sounds, I mean, they're the raw material for narrative, in a way. You can make up your own story around them. When I was reading that, what I thought of was at the end of the song Caroline No by the Beach Boys, it's the last song on Pet Sounds, there's a train whistle and a dog barking. And you just listen to it and you think, well, where's the train going? Who's on it? Is it the guy we just heard singing about breaking up with his girl? Does he know where the train's going? Does he care? Does he feel like his life in that town is over? Is that his dog? You know, missing him already and knowing something's wrong. Is he leaving the dog behind along with everything else in his hometown? And thinking about it can break your heart. But you don't even have to think about it. Just hearing it can break your heart, if you have any heart, I guess. And when I was very young, in the 1950s, there was a television show, I think, you know, I tell this story a lot, and it occurs to me I might be making it up. But this is what I remember. There was a television show, it was a mystery show, a mystery series that I can't remember the name of, and it would end each week with an off-screen voice intoning, "Next week's mystery will involve." And he would name three objects, each of which we would see as he said it, you know, a hand would come down. And so we saw all the three things together, and it would be like a clock radio, a tube of lipstick, an airline ticket, or whatever. And this is one of my most vivid memories from childhood. I would spend the next 7 days imagining the different ways that those three objects might go together in the same narrative. And the funny thing is, I can't remember a thing about the shows. I can't remember a thing about the series. I guess I like my own stories better. In any case, it was the raw material that seduced me, or to use Irene's word, beguiled me. And I think it's why I've always had a fondness for what are sometimes called list songs. You know, like The Tinkling Piano in the Next Apartment in These Foolish Things, or The Ile-de-France with All the Gulls Around It, or thinking of Bob Hope a lot this week, in Thanks for the Memory, Stockings in the Basin when a Fellow Needs a Shave. Those are just great details. In a way, there are only so many stories, and it's the details that make them different. Anyway, I wanted to spend the rest of our time together, in a way, making fun of jazz record collectors, and hopefully making fun of myself too, I guess. There are people, probably including many of you, there are people who collect, you know, sound, who collect found sound. And I think those people, the people who do that are heroes. Whereas those of us who collect LPs, those of us who collect records, and I include myself kind of reluctantly, because although I've never thought of myself as a collector, I look around my apartment and I see thousands of LPs and CDs and books and magazines. And yeah, so yeah, I guess that makes me a collector. And I spend all my time in my free time in used bookstores and used record stores. So yeah, you know, I guess I am. In a way, those of us who collect LPs, compared to the sound collectors, we're lazy bums. I mean, we're collecting, we're taking the easy route. We're looking for the finished product. You know, we're not looking for the raw material. And it's funny, jazz fans in general tend to be very ambivalent about recordings, no matter how many thousands they own, because it's been drummed into us for decades, as long as we've been listening to jazz, that the essence of jazz is in live performance, and that records are no better than souvenirs. My wife went to college in Buffalo when Archie Shepp was teaching there, and she told me that Shepp once began class by playing something by Charlie Parker, and then either on purpose or accidentally, he scraped the needle across the playing surface of the record. And he said, yeah, the class was kind of shocked, and he said, don't worry, it's only a record. You know, and okay, point taken, but if not for recordings, most of us here today would not be able to say we had ever heard Charlie Parker, or Art Tatum, or Clifford Brown, or Jelly Roll Morton, not to mention people who, there'd be no trace of Tony Frusella or Sonny Clark or Tubby Hayes or some of the names that really excite record collectors. It's funny, I mean, I just realized Archie Shepp invented scratching in a way, I guess, but anyway. On the other hand, Max Roach once said that recordings are the textbooks of jazz. In my case, that's almost literally true. I mean, in writing about jazz, I'm as likely, if not more likely, to reach for an LP to double check something, as I am to reach for a discography, excuse me, or a reference book. But I don't think this explains why rare records become such fetish items. I mean, I'd probably have as many records if I didn't write about jazz. I think the reason they become fetish items has something to do with a built-in paradox. LPs were mass-produced. There were hundreds, or usually even thousands, of copies of even those LPs that received limited distribution. And yet, with the passage of years, a mass-produced recording can somehow become as precious and as sought after as an original painting or sculpture, a one-of-a-kind object of art. The same is true for, like, you know, paperbacks and things like that, just things that were meant for mass consumption that somehow went out of print. High culture, by which, I mean, this is not my distinction, this is the common distinction. High culture, by which I mean Beethoven, Rembrandt, things like that. High culture winds up in museums or in concert halls that might as well be museums or mausoleums. Popular culture, under which heading I include jazz, even though it usually isn't so popular, which is another paradox for another time, popular culture is regarded as ephemeral, transient, disposable. So it winds up in flea markets. And the randomness of it all, the randomness of finding anything, of just coming, you know, coming, we all have our list of things we want, but, you know, it's not like we're going to go into a store and find all of them. So just the randomness of coming across anything, the element of surprise, is part of the lure. It's part of the thrill. You know, the humorist, David Sedaris, I know him casually. And somebody else I know, well, when David moved to France, somebody else I know wrote him a letter saying, so have you been to the museums? And he wrote back saying, no, because I don't like to see anything that I can't buy. I don't like to see anything that isn't for sale. So he was going to clothing stores and books, used bookstores, you know? I thought, yeah, there's a guy after my own heart. There are, I don't know how many rare records in my collection that are there simply because I happen to be in the right city on the right day. And there are jazz records that are as rare as, I was going to say that it's, there are jazz records that are harder to find than weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But I mean, there are jazz records. But I also say something that I don't even understand. There are jazz records that are as rare as hen's teeth, whatever that means. I was in England. I noticed this was about 10 years ago. There was a store in London on Shaftesbury Street. I think this was in Ray's, a store called Ray's. Near the door, they had this box, and it was marked hen's teeth. So I looked through it. I think I found two records by Clarence Shaw. So I assumed it meant rarities, things that were hard to find. The other thing that I think lures many record collectors is a preoccupation not just with the past, but with the recent past, that period of a year or two or 10 or 20 maybe, just before you started listening to jazz and buying records, the period you just missed, in other words, and it'll always be beyond your grasp. And I think this is why, original Blue Note pressings so fascinate people around my own age who started listening to jazz in the late 60s, by which time Blue Note had been bought by someone else and it lost some of its luster. I mean, there's a sense in which we're all Gatsbys, we're all like the Great Gatsby, born back ceaselessly into the past, except instead of a green light, we're reaching for, I'll have to explain this, we're reaching for an ear. The original pressings of Blue Note Records in the dead wax had this like little ear. And even now, if you look on eBay, it'll say something like, Hank Mobley, Dippin', ear. So if you know, you know. And people who like that sort of thing get very, very excited. A record that I finally got a few years ago that I had been looking for forever, or, ever since I started listening to jazz, is a record called Coleman Hawkins, a documentary. It's a double record on Riverside from 1957, on which Coleman Hawkins talks about his life and his career. It's not really a valuable record. There aren't that many people looking for it, I think, but it's an extremely valuable one in another sense. We don't have very many records. It's valuable as oral history. And I happened to mention one day that I was looking for it during a phone conversation with a record dealer on the West Coast. I'm going to change everybody's name, by the way, because it occurs to me, some of these people might be here, for God's sake. So anyway, it was a record dealer on the West Coast whose name shall be Tom. And Tom very kindly said that he would sell me his own copy. And he said, "I don't collect records anymore. That's a sickness." So, but after we agreed on a price, and I was taking down his address, he said, "But listen, if you have any colorful stamps, I mean, they don't have to be rare or anything, although that would be nice, but if they're colorful, why don't you use them on your letter? That's what I'm into now." And I thought, wow, this is like in one of those movies where there's an AA meeting, and nobody's boozing, nobody's drinking, but everybody there is chain-smoking and gulping coffee, And at least you're not drunk, I guess. But anyway, there is such a thing as an addictive personality. That, ironically, I think many artists have addictive personalities. It would explain why, would help to explain heroin in jazz, would help to explain alcoholism in American literature. That's maybe one thing that collectors and the artists they collect have in common. Because record collecting is a low-grade addiction. It's an obsession, or a compulsion. I never remember what distinguishes one from the other, and I'm both, so, it doesn't matter in a way. But along with collecting in general, and maybe with jazz itself, it's also a very male pursuit. Women seem to lack that collecting gene, for whatever reason. And I know any number of men, including some pretty well-known jazz critics, whose wives exile them to the garage or the attic along with their records. And these are the guys who hang out, you see them hanging out in used record shops on Saturday afternoons, the way that, Hank Hill from King of the Hill or other men hang out in Home Depot, And, listen, I know because I see them there. I'm there myself. Not that I'm a collector, but, but I'm luckier than most men because my wife lets me keep my records in our living room. The only problem, though, is that even though she's not obsessive about it, she owns quite a few books and records herself, and they're taking up space that I could use. So, you know, it's just a girl, can't live with them, can't live without them. But anyway, there's something, let's face it, and I hope nobody gets offended, because I include myself here. There's something very nerdy about collecting things, collecting records. And like sometimes when I hear comedians on television make fun of Star Trek people, I figure, yeah, that's because they don't know about us. You know, I mean, or, you know, anyway. There was a guy here in Philadelphia, we'll call him Sid, who owned a record store, who I remember once he said to me, I'm looking for Blue Note 8190, or something like that. I don't remember the actual number, but I'm looking for Blue Note 8190. If you ever see it, do me a favor, grab it for me. And I asked him what it was, and he said, I don't know, but I have 8189 and 8191, so there's a gap. And it was then that I realized that he kept his records by label and number, you know, not by artist the way, the way most of us do, I would trust, and that he was a completist, a word that I found out about 20 years ago when I used it in an article. There was no such word. It was just a word that, you know, you come across a lot in jazz magazines and collectors magazines, but it's a wonderful word, and it describes my friend Sid, and it describes a lot of us. But for Sid, it went beyond liking or not liking a particular musician. I was in a store one time, and I picked up a Cecil Taylor LP that I was, you know, sure he would own, and I asked him how it was. And he said, I don't know, man. You don't listen to Cecil Taylor records, you just collect them. and then, you know, guys like this, really, it's also, I mean, they love to gloat. Another time, I used to call the store every so often, you know, to see whether it was worth, I was managing another store at the time, but, you know, this was a chain store, so I didn't have the freedom that he had to order imports and obscure things and all that. I wasn't writing the checks. So I used to call him every so often to see if there was, like, you know, a compelling reason to go down to his store that day. And I remember I called him one afternoon, and I said, anything new? And he said, you got to get down here. You got to see the stuff I got from Japan. So I kind of, like, hastily, rearranged the schedule of the store I was managing so that I could, you know, be gone for a little while. I went down there, and I said, I looked around, and I didn't see the stuff. And I said, where is it? And he said, it's in those two boxes over there. So I got down and I went through the two boxes, and yeah, it was great stuff. I mean, it was like Japanese reissues of lots of things from the 50s and new records. This was in the late 70s. New records by people who weren't recording here at the time and all that. So, money, they're not marked yet, so money's flashing through my, how many can I afford, you know? So I go up to the counter with about 10 of them, and I hand them to him, and he says, what's this? And I said, well, they're the ones I want. He said, oh, they're not for sale. I said, well, why did you want me to come down here? He said, I wanted you to see what I got for myself. Yeah. So, you know, anyway. The ultimate collector, at least the ultimate collector that I know, is a guy we'll call Brian. And Brian not only has everything, he has two or three of everything. And is always looking to trade or make deals, you know. And he won't, you know, he'll very reluctantly sell you something. Really, you have to talk him into it. He wants to trade you. Now, he values obscurity above all else. And for years, his passion was jazz from the 60s, from the former Soviet bloc. And then he got all those things that he was looking for. So now he switched to Japanese modal players from the 70s. And, you know, so I'll be over his place looking through his doubles, as he calls them, where he has like 10 copies of things. and he'll put something on. And he'll always put on like a Japanese alto player playing a Burt Bacharach song as though it were My Favorite Things or something like that. And the piano player is playing like, you know, McCoy Tyner. And Brian would not be able to explain to you what a mode is. But he can tell it when he hears it, and he says, it's modal, you hear that? And you know, he'll hold up the record, and he'll say it's by, I don't remember the names, and he'll say, when you get interested in Japanese modal players, and you will, you'll want this. But I really like that, and you will, because the assumption there is he means that you get to a point where you have pretty much everything you want. There's nothing left to get excited about, and you still need your fix, so you move on to something else, which brings up what I like to think of as I'll use a real name here, Bob Blumenthal's rule. Bob is a jazz critic in Boston, and a very good one, and a very respected one, and a friend of mine. And I remember I was talking to him on the phone one day, and I must have been on vacation in Santa Cruz, and he was asking me how the record stores were. And I was saying they're, you know, pretty good. And he was describing the stores in Boston, where he lives, where they're really good. And he said, yeah, but you know, the problem is I have most of the stuff that's going to turn up there. So what I've started doing is buying records that I've passed up for 10 years. You know, I'd see them every week, you know, and he had just bought a record by the trumpeter Jack Sheldon called A Jazz Portrait of Ray Charles. And he said, you know, I still look at this and think, yeah. He said, you know what, it's pretty good. But the point is, the point ought to be that I found it the next day in Santa Cruz. But the point is, you still need your fix. It's sort of like you still need the hunt, I guess, is what it comes down to. I have to tell more stories about Brian. There's a sort of like post Velvet Underground rock band called Sonic Youth, whose leader Thurston Moore is himself a record collector. So much so that Thurston Moore, the magazine Cadence, has a regular feature called the questionnaire, which musicians are invited to fill out and give answers to, I think it's 20 standard questions. The questions don't change, only the respondents do. And one of the questions is, how do you relax? Thurston Moore said, by filing records. He didn't say by listening to records, he said by filing records, which I think is revealing right there, right? But anyway, Thurston Moore is especially fond of free jazz, avant-garde stuff from the 60s and 70s. And it was inevitable that somebody would put him together with my friend Brian. But Brian, of course, had never heard of Thurston Moore. He had never heard of Sonic Youth. So here's this guy, you know, going through Brian's records and picking out tons of them. And Thurston Moore, like most people, wasn't carrying that much cash on him. I mean, Brian sold him something like $3,600 worth of records. And he wanted to write a check, and Brian called me and said, do you think it'll be okay? Does this guy do well? and I said, yeah, you should take his check. And he said, you know, but his wife's a musician, too, as if to say, well, who supports them, you know, because like in Brian's world, you know. But then I think what happened, one of his neighbors, the daughter of one of his neighbors, found out that Thurston Moore was there and came over for an autograph, so that made everything okay. And like one more story about this guy. He was looking through my stuff one time, and he saw this record by Blossom Dearie called Rootin' Tootin' Hits of 1963 or something, with Jerome Richardson. It's a really good record. It looks kind of like it's going to be corny. And as near as I can figure out, it was a send-away record. You know, if you probably had to send so much, like a couple dollars and six higher root beer caps or something to get it. And I found it for next to nothing. And, you know, Brian kept offering me more and more money for it because he knew Japanese collectors who he could, you know, sell it to or trade. But I wanted to keep it, you know. But then I found another one. And, you know, I called them right away, because this meant I could trade for something very valuable that he had. And he said to me, is it clean? And I said, well, you know, it's a little noisy. But I think maybe they all were, because, you know, it's not a quality pressing. It's a record by mail. And he said, when I say, is it clean, I mean, does it look clean? And knowing I could, you know, go in and clean it on this record cleaning machine I have, I said, yeah, Brian, it's real clean. So I got like a really valuable record for it. Anyway, This is also a guy who I found out one time when I had an extra ticket to see Lee Konitz somewhere. Had never heard Lee Konitz live, even though he had hundreds of Lee Konitz records. That's kind of bizarre. So anyway, I don't know how you can talk about record collecting of any sort today without talking about eBay and how eBay has revolutionized the whole thing, for better or for worse, or maybe for better and for worse. On the plus side, I should have written down some examples. I have, because of eBay, I have records that I not only wouldn't I have them, I wouldn't know about them. There's things from other countries that just turn up. I mean, unless I happened to be, you know, in a record store in Belgium on a certain day, I would never have heard about this record. So it's wonderful in one sense. But it's come at a price. First of all, I mean, there's this strange eBay subculture where you're looking. I mentioned Ear as one of the listings, but when I started cruising eBay, when I started looking at eBay, I didn't know what OBI meant. OBI is this, on Japanese records, there's this band that's OBI. And if the OBI is not there, the record's value is cut by half somehow. I don't know. And then you see it says, like, you know, beats, which means it's something that can be sampled, because in addition to, like, veteran jazz collectors and jazz fans, now you have DJs. Yeah, looking especially for records from the early 70s, like sort of Pharoah Sanders type things and all that, that they can sample. And that's really driven the price of a lot of records up. And Ear, I've already mentioned. Another strange marking is cheesecake. Like if there's, like, you know, in the language of the day, a chick on the cover in a bikini, you know, there are people that collect that sort of thing. But one that really shocked me was you occasionally see, you know, John Coltrane, Lush Life, Heroin, or Art Pepper, straight up Heroin. And you open the page and there's no mention of Heroin, and all I can figure out is that there are people there somewhere who just collect records by junkies, or former junkies, across the board probably, they'll collect rock records. It's like some sort of vicarious high, I guess. And you wish they'd have a vicarious overdose in a way. And then like, man, two usernames that everybody on eBay, on the jazz lists, has to live in fear of, are Trot and Gallop and On Demand. All I know about these guys is that they're Japanese collectors, and they'll bid any amount of money for the records they want. If you see something you want, and it's like fairly low at that time, and you see that one of those guys is bidding on it, you just drop out. You can't win against these guys. And they always seem to bid on the same records. So, you imagine all sorts of things. They're like, you know, really rival collectors in Japan. And you know, it's kind of like Rodan versus Godzilla or something. I mean, you know, really, don't even go near it. And then, like, the most frustrating thing is, I think it's called sniping. Is it sniping? Is that the word for it? Yeah, like, you know, you've been the high bidder on a record, and you so much so that you think it's yours by now, you know, you're imagining it and so on, and you know, there's like a minute left and you're looking and you're still the high bidder and you're hitting refresh and so on. There's 7 seconds left and you're still the high bidder, and then you hit refresh and the auction's over and somebody else won. And you go to the bid history and it's somebody who hadn't bid on the record up until that point. He's got some sort of software, some sort of program that allows him to top any bid by a dollar or 50 cents or whatever it is, like the final 5 seconds or 2 seconds or something. And I have to admit, there have been a few times where there's a record that I've wanted where I bid way more than it's worth, knowing that I won't have to pay that much, where I figure, okay, if you do this to me at the last minute, the last seconds, you're going to pay for it, buddy. And it hasn't worked. I mean, you know, they haven't done it on those, but anyway. But the bad things about eBay, I guess it can be summed up. If you were to ask me, what are the record stores that you should visit while you're in Philadelphia? I mean, I have a few suggestions, but I'd almost have to caution you that they ain't what they used to be. Most, as in most other cities, the people in these stores are now putting their very best items on eBay. And in the short term, that's really helped them out, and it helps us out. I mean, we find things, you know, because we can bid on a record from Germany or something. We don't have to be in Germany. But in the long run, I wonder, for a couple of reasons. I mean, how do used record stores get records? They get them because they walk in. I mean, they buy collections, but very often records just walk in, as they say. And the people who have records to sell are generally, the way these things go, people who are in the market for buying records, too. So I think as there becomes less and less reason for us to go into these stores, these really interesting records are going to stop popping up there. They're going to stop walking in. And then, I mean, those guys I mentioned for whom record stores are like Home Depot, the little shops they go to are gradually going to vanish. And they're going to go out of business, or they're going to do strictly online. And that's a shame, because for a lot of us, those shops are our only effort at community. And for some of us, maybe our only opportunity for human contact. and it saddens me, too, because I think of it as part of a larger trend. As cyberspace is expanding, our physical space, the space we inhabit with our bodies, the space that we share with one another, is crumbling. I mean, I don't want to sound like Travis Bickle or the Book of Revelations or anything, but take a look around. I mean, take a walk around this city. It's falling apart. And it's going to get worse because of the tax cuts and because every city and every state is broke at this point. 100 years ago, which isn't that long ago in human history, you had to leave the house to hear music. You had to leave the house to witness entertainment of any sort. You had to leave the house to work, which many of us don't have to do anymore. I mean, there are going to be journalists, and you know, good journalists, who have never had the experience of actually working in a newsroom, of a newspaper, with people yelling at each other and all that. And that's a loss. And I think all of us are becoming much more isolated as a result of I know this makes me sound like a technophobe, and I'm not. I use my computer a lot, even if there are many things I don't know how to do on it. Maybe somebody can show me how to set up my scanner, you know. Anyway, but I'm not a technophobe. But I think it's making us all much more isolated. I have one more friend who I'll mention, a guy named Darren, who doesn't have many other friends, in part because he's kind of socially awkward, but also his work has forced him to live in many different cities, and he was moving back here, and. You know, realized that this is where he grew up, but he didn't know many people here anymore. And he was telling me that he did have one friend, other than me here, a virtual friend, somebody he communicated with. And, I mean, I'm glad he has a virtual friend, but I thought, like, virtual friend, I mean, I guess that's better than an imaginary friend that we have when we're children, but not by much. You know, there was something very, very sad about that, and I think it's where we're headed. I wanted to read something. I see the time is running out here, but this maybe makes you think that might make you think that record stores disappearing might not be such a bad idea. This is a piece I wrote about Rahsaan Roland Kirk. I explain most of this in the part I'm going to read you. But Rahsaan was a record collector. I mean, most musicians are not, for whatever reason. I mean, you can't make generalizations. Younger musicians tend to be more interested in collecting records or just hearing records than older musicians and so on. But Rahsaan Roland Kirk wanted everything. He used to shop in a store that I worked in, and he would call to see what was new. And whatever you'd say, whatever you'd list, he'd say, put one aside, put one aside. The only things he didn't buy were things that were on Atlantic, which he got for free. And it didn't matter if the record was, you know, like a really kind of schlocky commercial record. He usually knew the musicians, and he wanted to hear them, wanted to hear what they were doing with it. So anyway, in a piece I wrote about him, I began by talking about that experience. It figures, I suppose, that the first jazz musician I got to know offstage was one who was larger than life there, too. I met Rahsaan Roland Kirk in 1971. No, I inherited him when I was hired as record buyer for Radio 437, a Philadelphia audio store, whose selection of jazz imports put to shame any in New York, at least according to Rassan. I remember him telling me that what had first lured him into the store was our voluminous stock of Folkways African LPs. He had no way of knowing that those very albums had hastened my predecessor's departure. African field recordings must have seemed like a good idea in those days of nascent cultural nationalism, when even our older black customers were starting to wear dashikis and grow naturals. But Rassan was practically our only customer for them, and in desperation, my bosses slashed prices on our Folkway stock and hung a large banner announcing, "Radio 437 is returning to the roots," which prompted one of my colleagues in the record department to quip, "Sure, all the way back to Moloch, the first thief in the Old Testament." A friend of mine, a native New Yorker, who wandered in during a heated argument I was having with one of my bosses, described 437 as Philadelphia's only Brooklyn store. Conversations there tended to be shouting matches, and if no Yiddish word existed for something, my bosses would make one up. Crappy equipment, bought cheap, and sold at a high markup was a klamas. I used to think that was a real Yiddish word. It's not. Anyway, it was their word for it. Every day at 437 was an object lesson in the tensions that can result when one ethnic group is doing the selling and another is doing the buying. To our audio salesmen, the adage that the customer is always right meant telling Schwatzes, their word, with money to spend, whatever would close the sale, telling them what they wanted to hear, in other words, what they thought they wanted to hear. One day, as I slouched against the A-tracks, yawning away a hangover, I heard the owner's brother tell a black couple that Panasonic was the brand that all the brothers were buying on account of what he described as the company's enlightened hiring policy. The next day, his pigeon was a turbaned Indian. "Panasonic," he rasped. "It's the brand that the Pakistanis swear by." So into this madness walked Rassan Roland Kirk, whose sightlessness must have given him the look of an easy mark. I don't know exactly what happened on his first trip in, because it was before I was working there, but the story had it that he paid cash for an armload of records and accused the cashier, the owner's brother again, of shortchanging him. The upshot was that Rassan insisted on writing a check on subsequent visits, only to be informed that no check could be accepted without a driver's license. And of course, Rassan was blind, so he didn't have a driver's license. So intervening on his behalf, I would be required to initial his check, the implication being that the amount of his purchase would be deducted from my salary if his check bounced. Then, as a standard courtesy to the blind, I would slit open the shrink wrap on his albums. The whole time this was going on, my bosses would smile blandly at Rassan, as if to say, "It's store policy, babe. Nothing personal." Rassan, meanwhile, would scowl at them and glare, his eyeballs, when not hidden behind dark glasses, jumping every which way, though his head never moved and his expression never changed. I mean, that's real life, and you have to go outdoors to find it. You can't kind of sit on your computer and find it. If there's time, Sam, is there time for like a little 5-minute excerpt of something? I brought a CD that someone recently made me a CD of Albert Eiler oddities. Eiler playing at John Coltrane's funeral in 1967. Eiler in Scandinavia somewhere with Cecil Taylor in 1963 and things like that. But one of the most curious and most fascinating things on it is Albert Eiler and his I don't think she was his wife at the time, but his woman partner, Mary Parks, trying to get on an airplane in Luxembourg in 1970. Apparently the airlines were overbooking even then. So even though they had tickets, and you'll hear a guy assuring them that they're going to get on the plane, they're not so sure. And Eiler keeps telling them that they don't understand. He needs to be on television. We'll talk about that later. Because Albert Eiler was not on television very frequently. And Mary Parks, kind of like really vying for pest of the week from the airlines. And it's the sort of thing that I think would get them sort of branded terrorists, potential terrorists today. I don't think they could get away with this stuff. But anyway, so this is Albert Eiler in 1970.
Yeah.
Again, the sound gets better.
Mr. Heidecko, it was confirmed by Mr. Heidecko of Aviation Marketing. And we were under contract, we have to be in New York, and he told us that we're supposed to leave on the 331st.
Five persons, yes?
That's right.
He's the reporter. And this is the luggage pouch.
That's right, persons. Right, that's right.
Okay.
Seems to be moving a little bit better now.
Yeah.
The sound is not. This is not as easy to listen to as I thought it would be. So, I'll just tell you about it. It fascinated me because Albert Eiler is saying, "I have to be on TV. I have to get back in New York because I have to be on TV." And Albert Eiler was never on TV. I would know about it. He was not. And then I figured out what he's talking about. He's not lying. In the summer of 1970. Rahsaan Roland Kirk and a bunch of other musicians started disrupting the taping of many of the talk shows in New York to demand more jazz on television. And the only they'd come to the studio with kazoos and whistles and things like that and disrupt the taping. And the only two shows that responded in any way were Dick Cavett's show, which gave them a half hour just for a panel discussion. And the Ed Sullivan Show. Ed Sullivan gave these musicians, I think, like 3 minutes at the end of one of his shows or something. So you had, like, you know, 45 musicians on stage all taking, like, you know, two-note solos or something. And I remember, I know Rahsaan participated in it, and I know Archie Shepp did. I don't think Eiler did, but I think that's what Eiler was trying to get back to New York for. So he wasn't lying. You know, he really did want to be on. He really did need to be on TV, and I think it's really kind of touching in a way that, even though this was a protest, for Albert Eiler it meant I'm going to be on television. You know, so anyway, that's. I'm sorry that wasn't easier to listen to, but I think it would have been kind of painful. Are there any quick questions? I don't think so. No, he definitely wasn't on the Cavett Show. The Cavett Show was a panel discussion, and you know they all were announced individually, and it was Rahsaan, Cecil Taylor, Freddie Hubbard, Andrew Surreal, and I think maybe Jimmy Owens. I don't remember exactly, but Albert Eiler definitely wasn't there, and he may have been on the Sullivan Show. It was kind of hard to tell who was there and who wasn't there. There were so many people. But anyway, this is like my example of found sound. I mean, this just—it's worthless in any objective sense. But I'm just like fascinated by it. You know, just to hear Albert Eiler talk, to somebody from the civilian world, the street world. You know, like trying to explain. Luxembourg. How did I get it? That's what I don't know. That's what I don't know. But it's authentic because at the end you hear the when they're announcing the people who can get on the plane, you know, who are, maybe. But when you're announcing the people who, when you hear the announcement of the people who can get on the plane, you hear you know, Tintweiss or whatever, you know, you hear Eiler's whole band being announced, and they're mispronouncing the name so that he becomes Eiler. Or something like that. So it's authentic, and I got it because somebody I know who does a radio show in Princeton, somebody gave it to him, so he made it for me. So this is probably out there, but I really doubt that anybody will ever issue an LP of Albert Eiler boards a plane. If it were Sun Ra, people would, I think, you know, because you know, people are just like more fascinated by Sun Ra. Just the whole idea of Sun Ra doing anything sort of intrigues people. You know, Sun Ra walking among us, but which, if you lived here in Philadelphia, Sun Ra walked among us all the time. You'd run into Sun Ra with somebody from his band parking his car, or like Sun Ra, the store that I work in with, where Rahsaan used to come in, Sun Ra came in one day to buy batteries. I thought, gee, he's battery powered. You know, he's going to, you know. You know, and then Sun Ra did a concert at the public radio station here, WHYY. And I'm not quite sure what they needed them for, but they had to borrow safety pins, probably for the costumes. So, you know, it's just like Sun Ra. What if Sun Ra were one of us, you know? He was. Anyway, but I know we're running late, so. Is there another question at all, you know? More about Stanley? Okay, yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Sam.
I think there are as many sort of found sound collectors mm-hmm. here. I mean, I bet even if you got even thing that isn't considered found sound, people who taped audio off television before there were videotape recorders.
Oh, you know,
One quick story about Francis. When I met him a few months ago, he was talking about record collecting, and he told me an anecdote, or told this group an anecdote about watching either High Fidelity or Ghost World. I don't remember which it was, but each is a movie about a record collector, and basically a dysfunctional sort of socially disabled record collector. And he was watching the movie, and his wife walked by and said, "There but for me go you." And I think with that, I want to introduce Francis's wife, if I may, who's over here, who's the producer and host of Fresh Air, Terry Gross. And I want to welcome her. Thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to have a